Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. I'm going to be heading out on the serendipitous synchronicity, comedic marriage of Mars and Venus, beauty, Trump's tyranny, blessing, poker, 7 of 7, equinoctial tour. I'll be at Open Secret on March 20th at 8 p.m. That's a solar eclipse and the equinox. March 21st at 2 p.m., I'll be at Commonweal in Bolinas, California, a short talk and a long interview with wonderful ally Michael Lerner for the New School. On Thursday, March 26th, Mystic in the Marketplace Tea Party with Mary Waldner. More information on that. And then I'll be returning to Santa Cruz after many, many years away. Saturday, March 28th at 7 p.m., Astro Political Lecture Theater with troubadour bard David Lynn Grimes. Yes. And then that will be followed March 29th at 3 to 6 p.m., a trickster training tea party with a purpose, teasing forth and embodying the themes of Saturday's equinoctial talk, metaphoric agility and dedicated acts of beauty, Trump tyranny. That will be at the Center for Spiritual Living in Santa Cruz. More information on website, coyotenetworknews.com. And if you and I are very lucky, you will see me wearing a fantabulous Afghani Suzani coat that our wonderful guest will tell us about. But first, let me weave a little bit of context. Right now, straight up overhead in Northern California, Venus and Mars are getting married. They're courting. They're straight up overhead in Pisces, the realm of dreams and reverie. And they're going to hold hands and cross the threshold and conjoin very late Saturday night in Aries at the comedian degree. And we go, oh, excellent. Venus and Mars don't get married that often. We know that the world is being destroyed by hyper-yang, uninitiated Mars. Mars with no intimacy, no art, no sense of beauty and protection of the community. Because it is Venus, it is art that weaves the world together. So we remember, you know, in ancient Greece, when Hercules was destroying the world, the gods got together and sentenced him to go to the underworld to learn knitting and weaving. So we think of, you know, the Dementors, Dick Cheney, you know, in the underworld, knitting tea cozies. There we go. We remember our ally Martine Prechtel, who often says, to feed the indigenous soul, have around you handmade things that either you know who made them or you know the story of who made them. They feed you. You know, we also want to honor the souk, the marketplace, the beautiful souk in Aleppo where Deborah Felmuth took me so many years ago, the oldest continuous souk in the world, 2,500 years of continuous marketplace until now, oh humans. But we know that the marketplace, indeed the sun has just entered Pisces, and its image is the crowded souk, the crowded marketplace, as a place, again, to heal the community. So we're healing our relationship to the marketplace. We remember the beautiful Balinese saying that says, we have no art, we simply do everything as beautifully as we can. So this wedding of Venus and Mars, handmade art is the antidote to war. We welcome our guest, Timur Zamani, who with his family for generations have been keepers of the beauty of Afghanistan, that wherever there is strife, may we find and support beauty. The image for this new moon, just behind us, is strange white flowers are blooming in the midnight ruins of Babylon. Beauty is triumphant. His website is ZamaniCollections.com. Welcome, Timur.
Thank you so much, Caroline, for having me here.
Oh, it is my pleasure. And, you know, we love weaving and synchronicity. It is my new old friend, Abigail Greenway, who said, when she met you, so many things opened up. She was walking down the street, and this lovely man said, please come in to my store. Do you remember this? Yes.
Right.
And she entered, and she met Masood and started many things, and so she told me that, so I was like, I could use a new opening. So as I was walking down the street, there I entered your store, and it was fantastic. It was the souk, and we had a lovely conversation that we're going to continue now. But we love the weaving of synchronicity. We meet, we follow, we connect, and then reciprocal blessing. How can we, you know, do, how can we bless each other? I told you backstage just now that when I was in Syria, the most useful phrase that Deborah Felmuth taught me was Islamu Idain, you know, may the divine bless your hands that have made such beauty. So I know, you know, that you and your family have been dedicated to preserving and honoring and the beauty of Afghanistan. So I thought it was perfect to welcome you to guide us into intimacy with the beauty of Afghanistan, because we hear so much that is terrible. So what is the tradition of your family?
Thank you, Caroline, again. I have to say, I consider myself very lucky to be born in a family where arts, crafts, woven things, textiles, rugs were cherished, and they were all around me. Not only were they around me, but the actual artists, the people, the families that were making these beautiful things, we would see them. They would bring the goods to our family, and my family traded in those arts. My grandfather used to export them in the 50s, 60s, 70s back to the US and Europe, starting from textiles to rugs to jewelry, Afghan arts and crafts. So not only was I able to see all those beautiful things, but also see the families and see how those things were made. I think once you see these artists doing their work at their job, your perspective really changes on those beautiful things. It's not just an item to beautify a place or to decorate. It becomes more than that when you see how much time and effort has gone into making them. Getting back to the beautiful coat.
The Suzani coat that I tried on and went, ooh, how beautiful. Do speak to us about that coat.
Sure.
Yeah.
Suzani, the word Suzani. Suzan means needle in Farsi and Persian, and in that language is spoken throughout Afghanistan, Iran, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. That's one of the languages, one of the main languages spoken. And so in Farsi, Suzan means needle. And Suzani is referred to textiles, embroidered textiles that are needlework. So Suzani, the actual meaning of it, means needlework. And the beautiful purple jacket is a Suzani needlework. So the whole embroidery is done by needle, and it's silk embroidery, and that's a jacket. But Suzanis go long way in Central Asian cultures. It dates over hundreds of years, and they were their treasures. That was their wealth. The families used to make that, and that was their wealth to trade it with other things, with other villages, other tribes. One tribe had food. They were known as a farming community. Another tribe was known for their textiles. So they would make these beautiful textiles and trade it with food with the other community. And so that's how that was their livelihood. And Suzanis were also, when a girl was getting married, or a guy was getting married, when he was, if he was trying to find, or his family was trying to find the right woman or bride for him, they would have Suzanis first and show the guy, the groom to be, Suzanis, and whichever Suzani he liked, he would ask to see that girl, whoever did that Suzani. So they go a long way in Central Asian culture, Suzanis. And the motives, the patterns are to do with nature. The round typical design of the Suzani is a symbol of the sun and the earth. And the flowers that you see on Suzanis, they're all nature. So everything was taken from nature for those.
No, I love that. And you know, at the very, very end of the Arabian Nights, when Scheherazade, whom I think of as a compassionate trickster who steps into the dangerous circumstance and goes, I will marry this insane person, and heal his heart. So at the very, very end, many of us know the frame story of the Arabian Nights, but when King Shahryar says, "You have saved me, you are my redeemer," and they become truly married, she wears a coat that is a wedding dress that is embroidered with all the plants and animals of this earth. And when I put on the Suzani coat, which you can see at coyotenetworknews.com, and also on my Facebook page, Coyote Network News, but I was like, ooh, this is what Scheherazade would have worn. You know, this is the, you know, the wedding of more than humans. This is the wedding of humans to nature, as all weddings should be, in a sense. Mm-hmm. You know, the wedding of Mars and Venus. And I wanted to just bring in, you know, Martine Prechtel again is very witty, and he talks about courtship, how Americans have lost the art of courtship, and he says, courtship, Venus and Mars, it's good for humans to court and to be respectful, and the art of intimacy, it heals our relationship to the earth. And he said, oh, American men, oh, okay. He says, what passes for courtship with American men is, look, I made a golden statue of myself for you. Anyway, so we're going back to this idea also of, you know, beautiful courtship as art. You were saying, you know, backstage that the men do the rugs, the women do the textiles, although it's more complex than that?
It is more complex. And here in the U.S., I do get a lot of questions where, you know, the rugs that we see, I know child labor has come up, and a lot of people think that those rugs are made, or those beautiful embroideries are made by children. We have to understand that is a huge talent, you know, when making a rug. Rug weaving is a huge talent. It doesn't just come up when you're 6 or 7 year old. Though it takes a long time to learn that technique, that talent, and by the time you're 20, 25, then you can start weaving a rug. Child labor, the whole concept came up in these industrialist countries where China, India, Pakistan, they have workshops, huge workshops of rugs. And so what they do is convince families to get their kids so they can put them under those looms and start making rugs. In Afghanistan, because you know, it's very tribal. Rug weaving is for tribes, for families. It dates back centuries ago. We don't have any formal workshops. So everything is made at home by families. And the technique is taught to kids by families. So child labor, first of all, it never existed in Afghanistan. And so that's one thing I like to clear. I get that a lot of questions about. So the things that we work with, the families, there is no child labor, but it is taught to their kids because that's their livelihood. So it's important for them to teach their kids how to weave those rugs, how to learn that technique of embroidery, so on. Coming back to your question, Caroline, weaving rugs or embroidery, it really depends on the tribes. You know, it's not defined as where men are only making rugs or women are only doing embroidery. In general, I would say more of the embroidery is done by women and more of rugs are done by men. But you also have families, women that are weaving rugs. You also have men that are doing embroidery. So it's really mixed. It's a cultural thing for them. Yeah,
and then all of the complexity, you know, the America's complex relationship to Afghanistan. And again, when I met you at your beautiful store, and you were saying, and this is a dowry, and this is a wedding dress, and I go, is it a terrible thing that Americans are, you know, looting the dowries and the wedding gifts, you know, and wearing them casually, you know, and is this a, you know, it's a complex thing. Is it a bad thing? And you said, no, but address the complexity of it. There are these wedding coats, the beautiful Suzani mm-hmm. wedding embroidery you brought in here that we're just telepathing to you radio listeners going, ooh, it's the sun, and it's purple, and it's white, and there's many that you can describe and translate for us. Mm-hmm. But or the coat that was a woman's wedding coat, you know. So how can there be respect, you know, and how do we honor the crafts of Afghanistan with respect, with full respect?
Well, Caroline, I have to say that weddings are a huge event for Afghans and the tribes that I know within Central Asia. It's a huge event. So they plan, they make things, embro coats for the bride and the groom years before, when the child is 9 or 10 years old, the mother and the father is already planning at this age when my son or my daughter gets married, this is what she's going to wear. This is what, so it's a huge event in their lives. So they do a lot for a wedding. And the best way to respect the culture, those arts, and I think is to put it out there, show it, wear it, and it's full of beauty. That's the best way I can think of it, is to wear it and show it. The more they're exposed, the more people are going to appreciate them, and that's what I am doing. I have a beautiful showroom. It's more of a, I call it a little museum. I've built this place where I can share all the beautiful things that I've been left from my family with. Things that are 17th century, 18th century, 19th century. You know, I call it a little museum because those treasures are museum pieces. And, you know, more than the selling and the buying part of it, I enjoy showing it to people who appreciate them, and that's sort of showing the beauty of the culture. And my aim is really that, especially with the war going on in the past 40 years in Afghanistan, the violence has really overshadowed the beauty of the culture. We have to remember, once upon a time in the 60s, 70s, Afghanistan was highly visited amongst tourists from US, from Europe, and it was very stable. Afghans are known for their hospitality. People who have visited Afghanistan, they have beautiful stories. People that come to my gallery and then they start crying out of just happiness that they see a place exists like this, where it's promoting arts and crafts of Afghanistan, Afghan culture in general. But in the 60s and 70s, Afghanistan was beautiful. We had it was very stable, very secure. People could travel all over Afghanistan, night, day, anytime. And I am sure all of those people, they have fond memories and stories of Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, I do remember. I mean, I was in India at the time, and I know the overland trek. But it was a difficult place. I talked to many women who, you know, naively traveled through Afghanistan, and they had a difficult time. I mean, it was you know, again, you know, the wanderer, the traveler should, you know well the customs, should know well the respect, but also, you know, how to be safe. But yeah, so here's the complex, you know, journey of Afghanistan and the beauty that is there. So, you know, and then, you know, and in as you say, the war for 40 years, 50 years or so.
Yeah.
You know, because we were speaking again backstage about, you know, handmade, and how much, you know, Deborah Felmuth, my wonderful ally, and I, in a little way, you know, honored to love Syria. And then you, of course, had said, but the war, you know, the war is destroying their art. You know, when will that happen? And then you said, you know, and Afghanistan's been at war for 50 years. Mm-hmm. So how now, you know, here's our complex realm, you know, so the Taliban are, no music, right? I mean, the Taliban are anti-music, anti-art, in a sense. So how safe, let's begin with how safe for musicians, and let's also, how safe for women and school and art now?
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question, Caroline. I have to say, and be very honest in this question, 40 years of war, it has really changed Afghan culture. You know, so we've had the Russian invasion. After the Russians left, we had the Taliban, a very barbaric regime that really did not represent our religion or our culture at all. They were just there to destroy our history, our culture. That's what the Taliban did. Then we, after the Taliban, when the international community sort of woke up and saw the atrocities that they did in Afghanistan. So once the international community entered Afghanistan, the US and the NATO allies, things changed in Afghanistan. The best way to compare now in the last 15 years and before that in Afghanistan, the best way to compare it is, 15 years ago, when the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were ruling Afghanistan, it was about survival for our people. We had over 2 million refugees living in Iran and Pakistan. And the families that could not leave Afghanistan, they had the most miserable life you could ever imagine under those regimes. Women were forced to stay home. Girls were forced to stay home, not go to school. Men were forced to have a beard. And it was really bad. So the best way I compared it, before, at those times, it was survival for our people, surviving for the day, for the week. They were looking at the sky, which way the rocket is coming from, so they can hide, so they can escape from it, which way the Taliban are coming from, so they can hide from them. That was 15 years ago. Now, it's not about survival for the day, for the week, or for the month. We do have problems. We have problems of poverty, corruption, unemployment. Those are the problems we have, where I think a lot of nations have those problems. So that's a big change. Nowadays, we have boys and girls going to school with their uniforms. When you wake up in the morning, I see, this is what I hear from people. That's a big hope for Afghanistan, when you see children going to school. Schools are being built. There are hospitals around. And we have a functional government. We had it's an elected government. We held elections after so long. And so these are good changes. But we still have a long way to go. You know,
well, we're in, and we are in this complex, dodgy realm. You know, many of our team view the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan as ineffective, wrong, cruel, the long military stay there as a bad thing. So we want to honor the complexity. So the Taliban largely still in charge in many places. Yeah.
There are pockets of the country that are ruled by the Taliban, but these pockets are not populated areas. These are desert, you know, it's just by name that they're calling it. But the Taliban have such a bad name in Afghanistan. Afghan people hate them very deeply. I don't think they will ever have a place in Afghanistan with the will of people. Now, by force they may, if the international community forgets and Afghanistan and abandons Afghanistan, like when the Russians left. Yeah, they're capable of coming and controlling the country by force. But if we have the international community behind us, the Afghans will never let the Taliban rule the country again, what they did.
So we hear here, you know, about the bombing of girls' schools by Taliban. That goes on as an occasional horror, but not something that is so strong as to keep young girls at home.
You're right, Caroline. Yeah, there are a lot of families have realized the power of education, luckily. So there is a lot of families that are still encouraging their daughters and sons to go to school. And around the capital, or closer to where the government has more control, things are okay. You know, and then when you travel outside the capital...
That's pretty recent,
outside
though.
The...
I mean, isn't okayness pretty recent?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do have those bombings in recent times.
Even 3 years ago, yeah. You know, bombs in Kabul.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Our village, actually, the village where my parents grew up, and I've never seen it, I've only heard about it, it's about 10-15 miles away from the capital. And recently, there was some sort of attack at a girls' school. And again, these are done by anti-government people, part of the Taliban movement, and they're just there to destabilize the government, you know. But Afghan people hate them, you know. And one thing I like to make clear, Caroline, I get a lot of questions from my American friends. They ask me, did we do good in Afghanistan, or are we just killing innocent people?
Weddings, bad PR,
That's
wedding
bad
party,
PR.
Wedding parties bombed there and also Iraq. Yeah.
In a war, there's always mistakes, but I don't think the invasion ever went and killed civilians in a wedding. You know, there was always some sort of gunfire or some sort of mistaken identity
we do have to put on the table. I mean, there were bombs of weddings in Iraq.
In Iraq,
and not in Afghanistan, is
We had a few occasions.
So.
I've heard, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. We do want to honor the mm-hmm. the roiling complexity of it all. You know, it is your voice is most welcome. And unusual. You know, and when the Arab Spring began, you know, I was saying to Syrian friends and Muawiyah, wonderful, you know, married to Deborah, and I go, oh, it is Arab Spring in Syria. And he goes, no, it's going to be terrible. You know, every mercenary in the world will come in. The opposition doesn't have a clear strategy. And I was like, no, I really hope you were wrong. Oh, you weren't.
Mm-hmm.
So I had an uninformed, you know, but enthusiastic going, democracy in Syria, oh no, not so fast, okay. And in the same way, you know, we've felt like, oh, then, you know, the bombing of Afghanistan, you know, really terrible, because there are terrible things, and, you know, and people, innocent people from Afghanistan swept up and, you know, put in Guantanamo, and who are just, you know, cab drivers or weavers, you know, so many terrible things, but that brings us back to beauty. You know, as the healing dynamic and as complexity, again, the warp and woof of rugs going on, many things. Okay, so your story is welcome, you know, going, all right, and unusual on the Pacific airwaves to go, actually, the bombing, the American presence was welcomed. This is not something we think about often. So this is part of the complex weaving.
It is, exactly, Caroline. I mean, right now, if you went to Afghanistan, I have family, I have uncles, cousins, my parents travel to Afghanistan very often, and this is what they would tell you. People are actually you know, happy of what's been happening in Afghanistan in the last 15 years. And I believe Afghanistan has been a little successful story of the past 15 years of these wars. You know, we have really liberated a whole culture. Like I said, you have boys and girls going to school. You have an elected government, but we still got a long way to go. But overall, I just want to tell my American friends that the sacrifices that this country has given, the help and the investment that they've put in the country, it hasn't gone waste. We have liberated a culture.
Whew. Okay, this is a complex brew, but we are weaving it in, going, all right, that is welcome, and again, unusual for our dynamic listening audience too, but therefore welcome. We go, okay, nothing simple. And certainly, you know, for us now, and the dedication of you and your family, and we want to get back to the artisans of Afghanistan and how we can support them, which we'll do in our second half, so we'll think of that. How can we support the beauty in Afghanistan, you know, as a balance for the war? I think that we would still, as Americans or as just humans, understand that, you know, there have been many cruel and uninformed, you know, forms of violence inflicted by Americans on Afghanistan. That is mostly what we hear. You're bringing in a balance point, so that is welcome. We go, okay, complexity of perspective, that's right, looking at things from many, many different angles, nothing simple, especially, you know, I mean, I loved, you know, when traveling in, you know, in Turkey, and I would love to go to Afghanistan, and we will speak about how safe...
You would love it, Caroline.
How safe will it be? Well, we'll talk about that again after break, but I do enjoy saying to Turkish friends, excuse us, Americans, we are very childlike people. We really know very little of other people's history, let alone our own, because it's true. I mean, you know, to be engaging in a culture with its deep roots. So we're going to take a very short break, a musical break. Maybe you can guide us to the music we're about to hear, Timur.
Sure. The music that we'll listen now, it's there's three instruments involved in there, but the main instrument, it's a strings instrument, it's called rubab.
It's the say again.
Rubab, R-U-B-A-B. It's the national instrument of Afghanistan. It dates back 5,000 years. It's one of the first strings instruments invented. So it dates really back. This is when, before Islam came to that part of the world, this is, instrument existed. So it's a very beautiful instrument, beautiful deep sound, and it's the instruments of the Sufis.
Ah, yeah. Yes, we will speak more of them.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, and here we go. So beautiful, we couldn't stop. That was wonderful. This is the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Our wonderful guest is Timur Zamani, who with his family for generations have been keepers of the beauty of Afghanistan, that wherever there is strife, may we find and support beauty. So, Timur, tell us about that music and that musician that we just heard. It was so richly textured. It was like a carpet of sound itself. Yeah.
It is beautiful. And that instrument, to me, it really takes me back to Afghanistan, because in every household in Afghanistan, music is so huge part of our culture. And in every family, there is one or two people that plays either the rubab or the drums, you know. So music is running our bloods. It's all over Afghanistan, and it's a huge part of our culture. The music that we just listened to, the rubab was played by one of our very talented musicians, Humayun Sakhi, who lives in Northern California, actually. Uh-huh. And he's a well-known professional Afghan musician. He's known all over Afghanistan and also in the U.S. He's performed in different venues, from museums here in Washington, different states. So Humayun Sakhi, that's him. And the name of that song is called Josh, which means boiling.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Boiling, roiling. So well, again, when there's this destruction or hardship, it does create, Afghanistan, Iraq, New Orleans, it does create a diaspora of art that travels through the world. I mean, that is part of its complexity. And then also when the Taliban were in control, I mean, they did go around going, no music, right?
Oh, yes. Not only music, they stopped football, for example, soccer.
No music.
No music.
No soccer. No laughing.
I mean, the things that they forced people to do, it was totally against humanity. You know, things that as normal humans, the things that they stopped, they couldn't live. So one thing that I think we kind of underestimate and we don't talk about, the resilience of Afghan people as a whole. The different regimes that they have gone through, the atrocities that they have gone through, and yet when you go to Afghanistan, you see the hustle and bustle of the city, the smile on people's faces, you'd never think there was a war. So
really? Okay, so now this is good, because we wanted to ask about safety for women and musicians and artists, and you're saying it's safer.
It's safer especially for musicians, comparing it to Taliban.
So,
right now, that industry, our music industry, is thriving.
Uh-huh.
The musicians are making their businesses better than anyone's. There are weddings every night in Afghanistan, in Kabul. There are wedding halls everywhere, and they have not only one wedding at a day, but two weddings because they're so busy.
Hmm.
And so they always have in weddings in Afghanistan, you have a live musician. So there's so many different groups of musicians that have formed in the past 10 years. And it's very safe for them now. It's very open for
them. So for the likes of ourselves to go to Afghanistan now would be...
I think...
dodgy?
It would be a little dodgy, especially if you wanted to travel outside the capital. But within the capital, you know, there are a lot of... foreign people that are visiting Afghanistan. But as visitors, I'm not sure. They're mainly to do with work. So right now, I would not advise my friends to go
waiting.
As tourists.
We will not have a visionary activist tour. not yet. We'll wait for your go-ahead in that realm. But what I often say is, again, in the mythology is, yes, where there's Mars, let us find Venus. The midnight ruins of Babylon, which, of course, is Iraq. Let us find the beauty. And that the invader or the colonizer or whatever, in fact, needs the medicine of what he's or she is invading. I mean, England needed the metaphysic of India. And I do think that American culture needs the beauty of the Middle East and the beauty of Afghanistan. As you say, these are lives that are woven together in which beauty is a part of it. There's music in the home. As you said, every home has a musician, mm-hmm. and, weaving and that kind of quality. And as, Deborah Felmuth would guide us too, that the day is also woven together used to be. In Syria, you know, may it go well for you and for you. You know, is there anything else? Salam tek. You know, only your peace. That quality of blessing and poetry and art and music, you know, needed. So when the Taliban go, no laughing, no talking, no drinking, no soccer, no... So there was a great exodus of Afghani artists and musicians.
Huge,
right?
Huge, yeah. You had... like I said, the few families that stayed in Afghanistan, it's because they didn't have the means to go out, to get out. Everyone that could get out of Afghanistan got out of Afghanistan during the Taliban regime. We had, like I said, over 2-3 million people, refugees in Iran and Pakistan, and we had so many asylum seekers and during the Taliban regime in Europe and the U.S. that we've never had that sort of numbers before. And
so now is there a returning?
Yes, a lot of our refugees are returning back. A lot of, especially from Pakistan in Iran, because their lives were very harsh there in those countries. Now things are better in Afghanistan, and these are signs of peace coming to the country. You have refugees going back to Afghanistan. For example, a lot of our rug weavers were in Pakistan working for the huge workshops, rug weaving workshops. Now they're going back to Afghanistan. So what we are trying to do is put them back behind their looms so that we can keep the Afghan culture, their talents alive. And same thing with jewelry makers, Suzani embroiderers. So we're working very hard with different institutions, museums, and the government in Afghanistan to put these people back to their jobs, what they were doing before in Afghanistan.
So you know, we then, you know, extend to our wonderful dynamic listening community, you know, how can we support beauty everywhere? How can we support beauty and art in Afghanistan as the antidote to war? You know, and also that's why I was asking you, like, all right, so there's the incredible Suzani purple coat, Scheherazade's wedding coat, really. So the money that, you know, someone lucky enough, possibly me, may magnetize to give to you, that money will in some way go to the families. And that coat, you said, is well, it's almost antique. It's
yes.
70 years or
yes,
so old.
That's right, Caroline.
And then it goes back to the families to make sure that they can continue their dedicated artwork and bloom and thrive.
Exactly. That coat is 70 years old, but there's most of the things that are in the gallery, the things that we are newer things, same families making newer things. So these are jobs that we're creating for them. And every month we're getting shipments out of Afghanistan, rugs, Suzani's, coats, handbags, handicrafts, and we provide them to different institutions, museum shops, National Gallery of Art, the Textile Museum, the Metropolitan in New York. Their shops are selling these little Afghan arts and crafts. So, and these are all jobs that we're creating for our Afghan families that are going back to Afghanistan.
So again, the resources do go back.
They go back every month. Exactly.
That.
Every
yeah.
month, there's payments that go to Afghanistan to these families. We have our headquarters are in Kabul, so these families, when they're done with every month, when they make things, they bring them to the capital. That's where things are received from them, and the payments are handed out to them. So the main thing is job. And you asked me, what is the best way to support Afghan art, Afghan culture? Luckily, here in the U.S., we have a huge community of Afghans, especially in the California region, and also Virginia, New York, in the East. The best way to support is you have local Afghan stores. They all have Afghan arts, crafts, food. I warn you, Afghan food is addictive. Once you try it, you will want to keep trying.
Pumpkins.
So,
pumpkins,
eggplant, our rice dishes, and it's our cuisine is really it's very vast. That's just like our culture. When you go to Afghanistan, you will come across a Chinese looking person. You will come across a green eyed blonde hair guy. That is Afghanistan. It's so many different ethnic groups, and our cuisine is sort of like that. It's a mixture of Mediterranean, Arabic, Chinese, Indian. That is Afghan cuisine for you.
Yum.
Yeah.
And you know, this theme of syncretizing, right? We do want, you know, a global culture that is embracing of uniqueness, not suppressing of it, but, you know, but that honors the beauty of each culture. You know, when we were speaking also ways back, you know, I said, well, part of, you know, Turkey is that it's this, you know, well, like Afghanistan, you can guide us more better into that, but, you know, everything's moving through there. The land itself is, you know, there's a confluence. There's the Mongols who ride into Turkey with shamanism and then go, well, what's the game here? Okay, Islam. We'll put on an Islam mask on top of our shamanism, you know, and then all these, you know, so there's a lot going on again, you know, and it may be also that part of the complexity of the rug patterns, the complexity of the drumming patterns, you know, are a healing for the world, you know, rather than just doom, 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 simple. We want this complex weaving. We want syncretized going, we love this from here, but maybe not that thing, but we love that, and we blend it with this. So that's what you're saying is, in a sense, going on, this syncretizing. There's the Afghani food, which itself is from many different sources,
exactly.
You know, blended together.
Exactly.
And there is this, you know, so much, you know, of the beauty and complexity of Afghanistan that said, you know, Afghanistan is the soul of Asia. How it does is how all of Asia will do is an old saying.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying, all right, it's recovering, and how can we recover and support that with, again, the beauty, the complexity, the art, the textiles, the food, all of that as part of life. That was such a great musical selection. I will make sure to get the name of that wonderful musician playing the rubab. And you'd said one of the first, it's a 5,000-year-old musical instrument.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because that takes us to mythology. It's the, you know, Chiron, mythological mentor figure with a school for future cultural heroes. The first thing he does is he teaches his students how to take bows and arrows and turn them into stringed musical instruments. So from 2,500 years ago, we're still trying to learn that lesson, you know, the transformation of war through music and art into music and art. So you got the rubab is 5,000 years or so older. You said one of the first instruments and pre-Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also wafted around. You go, and something to do with Sufis. And I'm like, Sufis?
Mm-hmm.
All right, bring that back. Yes, what do you want to say about the complexity of... Yeah, well, so... almost all Americans know Rumi, born in Afghanistan, due to many translations, some, well, who knows. Yeah, I mean, are there translations of Rumi that you love?
I love Rumi myself. I actually, there was a point in time when I couldn't fall asleep without Rumi's poetry in the background, so...
Who was saying it?
We have... different poets in Afghanistan
So you have beautiful recordings of Farsi.
Yeah, of Farsi. The origin form of the poetry.
Ooh.
And when you translate it, I know, but sometimes it loses its, whether if it's humorous, if it's romantic, you know, it loses a little bit of that in it, in translation. But yeah, when you hear it in Farsi,
You must guide us to hear, even if we don't understand the words, to hear the sound of the words in Farsi.
I wish I knew a line in my head and I could translate right away, but there are many books of Rumi's work translated in English.
There are some
that we could get hold of.
That's right. Some.
Yeah.
Well, I will run them by you and go. And what do you think of this one? And what do you think of this one?
Because
it's dodgy. Most of the translators don't speak Farsi.
Yeah.
They have the English handed to them and then they play with it. But
and also, Caroline, I'm sorry, but I didn't get to finish. You asked me a good question. How we can support?
Yes. By all means.
The best way to support, you know, go to your local Afghan stores. Try our food. Decorate your homes with our beautiful rugs and textiles. If you're living in the East Coast, my gallery, which is a little museum of Afghanistan, I am in Georgetown, Washington, D.C., as well as Sterling, Virginia. You're more than welcome to come and experience a little bit of Afghanistan. We will treat you with a cup of tea, and you're more than welcome to see
cardamom.
With cardamom. In it. That's right. And our website is www.zamanicollections.com. And you're always welcome. Bring your friends, and we'll give you a little tour of Afghanistan.
And if you go to the website, there's much richness there. Although you do not have the vests. Abigail loaned me an Afghani vest. I'm like, how have I lived without this? Because we are here on the East Coast. We are in the new Arctic. We are the new Arctic. You know, we know everywhere is rock and roll. Mm-hmm. You know, 30-year drought in, you know, California and the Southwest, and you know, and we're in a, but as I stepped out the door, Abigail said, "Here, you need to wear this." I'm like, "Oh my God, I've hardly taken it off. I didn't bring it now, but it's so beautiful Afghani vests and the coats that were so popular in England.
Those are probably the most popular things from the 60s and 70s.
That's right. I remember. Yeah.
And the tourists who had gone to Afghanistan back then, I am sure every single one got either a fur vest or a fur coat. They're known as fur coats, sheepskin.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that was really, that's what our village did in Afghanistan.
No, I feel naked without it. I mean, I've basically been sleeping in it because it's 9 degrees and it's going down to -4 in Washington, D.C. So those are not on your website, but they are there.
And they're doing so well now. Oh. So 2 years ago, what I wanted to do, Caroline, I wanted to bring those old traditions back. I was thinking of ways of how do I create jobs? What will do well here in the West? So I was like, if they did well in the 60s and 70s, the fur coats, I'm sure it can do well. So 2 years ago, I told our villagers, start making those again, the fur vests, you know?
Yeah.
And it's from sheepskin. We're not killing any animals for it. You know, the butchers are bringing the sheepskin. And it's a long process the way they do it. But they're doing so well. I've sent them to Alaska, Colorado, New York. They're doing so well.
No, they're really, really good. Again, my loaner vest that I must divest myself of at some point, but I will come to your store and find another. I wore it inside and I would just step outside into 0-degree weather and it was fine. Inside, outside, it was, again, perfect. And yes, I remember it. Living in London, beginning to study astrology in the 70s, yes, we would go to, you know, possibly your relatives and go, Afghani coats, those fabulous, and I haven't seen them since until now at your beautiful museum.
The funny thing is, Caroline,
store.
I met a lady in Virginia about 2 years ago, and she had told me she was in Afghanistan in the 60s, and she had bought a sheep coat, and she brought it to my gallery. I asked to see, how it was. And she brought it to my gallery. My father was there. My father recognized it was from my family.
Ah.
And she had got it in the 60s in Afghanistan.
No, we love handmade. We love the story. We love the things are alive. They have their own genius. That is very wonderful. The complexity, certainly in the 60s and 70s in the Afghan route, was because Afghani hash was so famous.
Mm-hmm.
People in London would go, we have white, thin Afghani hash this week. And people go, oh, my God. Actually, that's also doing well because the Taliban also were making money from hash.
Yeah, exactly.
So that never went away exactly, or we don't
well, know? More than the hash, they're making more money from poppy.
Oh, the heroin, yes.
Exactly.
Right.
So it's unfortunate that Afghanistan is famous for poppy now. You know, back in the old days, Afghanistan was known for its beautiful rugs.
Hash, and they go well together. You know, I don't know. There was an annoying movie called Traffic, American, but there was a British version called Traffic. I don't know if you saw it. Oh, it was genius. And at one point, it has a British man and his daughter is, you know, an addict, and he's all, you know, he's part of the kind of British invasion in a bad way of Afghanistan. And a hash grower takes him up into the hills and they actually smoke up. And it's an amazing moment of smart British television. You can find it, everybody. It's the most respectful version of someone getting high in a good way, in which this person becomes reflective. And his Afghani guide says, why are you so hostile? What are you so, what are you so afraid of? And the man just in a soulful way says, I'm afraid I've forgotten how to feel. Anyway, but it's just a great, interesting moment. Anyway, so there's a very interesting, moment of a positive Afghani guiding, mm-hmm. So we put that to one side just as part of this rich brew that is bubbling away here, if we only had a pumpkin to put it in. So how can we support? We love that. Where there's Mars, let there be Venus. Let us love the beauty. We all have, many possibly not well translated Rumi, but they become part of our culture. Let the beauty we love be the beauty we do. There are thousands of ways to kneel and kiss the earth. That is how part of Rumi has come to us. We go, we love that. I don't know if you've ever heard, late, great street ally listener to show, Captain Cod, I think now an ancestor, but he came up to me and he said, I listened to your show and here's a bit of Rumi for you. We don't know, but he said, stop, be still, and listen, because you're drunk, and we're at the edge of the roof.
Oh, wow.
It's good. It's good. Robert Bly used that in an interview with Bill Moyers, what he'd like to say to George W. Bush, and Bill Moyers actually edited it out. But anyway, we've got it back there. So in our last moments here, really, like a really kind of a minute, It's disrespectful, but how can you begin to tease us, and we will do more with the Sufi influence that you mentioned, that you alluded to in the music and in the culture of Afghanistan. It's a huge thing. I know we're just going to do a little nuance.
I would have to have a musical party for you
okay.
to experience that, Caroline, and
excellent.
I would love to do that.
Excellent.
Yes, but thank you so much for having me here, Caroline, and it gives me an opportunity to talk about my culture, and that's what I'm really about. The reason I continued my family line of work to really show that culture, the beauty of that culture, and through that I will be able to help those people, those artists, with jobs and get their work out here and show it to people who appreciate beauty, yourself.
And may it be, a seed that we plant, that there be a renaissance, as you are narrating, of beauty and art and culture in Afghanistan, and may we see that in, Iraq and in Syria someday as well, this hope of a cultural renaissance led really by the artistic part of all of us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Caroline. Before I go, I want to end it with a nice little saying that we have in Afghanistan. It's qatra qatra darya megarda. Drop by drop makes a river. I am just a drop. Hopefully there will be more drops.
That is beautiful. That is our guest, Timur Zamani. His website is zamanicollections.com. Thanks always to Alex Drewinskis in Washington, D.C., and Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. I'm Caroline Casey. We will reconvene next week. And coyotenetworknews.com. You can see a picture of this incredible coat. Also, follow me on Facebook at Coyote Network News or Stand Up Coyote on Twitter, and you can also see the coat. Thank you so much, Timur. Woof. Hey, this is Caroline Casey, weaver of context for the Visionary Activist Show, a show that aspires to wed spiritual magic and conscious, compassionate social activism. Join us every Thursday at 2 p.m. as we invoke and implement a more ingeniously cooperative and reverent world.
Some folks know Tom Hayden as a revolutionary activist of the 60s, later California Assemblymember, then state senator. For all these years, Tom has been deeply involved with Cuba. Now he's talking about it. His new book is Listen Yankee, Why Cuba Matters. He'll be at First Congregational Church in Berkeley, 2456 Channing Way, on Tuesday, March 18th, 7:30 p.m. There's wheelchair access. The terrific Gloria LaRiva, also deeply familiar with Cuba, will host this KPFA benefit. Tickets at brownpapertickets.com and supportive bookstores. Find more info on the KPFA website about March 18th, Tom Hayden, Gloria LaRiva, Cuba.